This is CliffCentral.com.
CliffCentral.com on a Tuesday morning. It's the 22nd of May. Man, you're giving me two books. Is this a new fresh one? What's going on?
This is a signed one.
Oh, thank you. Okay, good. Because I've read that book. I read it over the last two or three nights. And first of all, congratulations, Tim Becker. It's a great book. And you've done something I think that's quite seminal here, because you've added to the historical outline of a profession which is admired and respected, but that part of it which is very little explored and very, very poorly understood by so many people in the profession. So well done, because you've brought, I think, some honor and some dignity to a lot of people who were bringing honor and dignity to people around them and have been forgotten by history in some cases, and sadly so, but I think you've brought it all back to life. So first of all, congratulations on a great book, but second of all, thank you for bringing up a story, and many stories, many individual stories of excellence, of dignity, of human rights, of land. Yeah. You know, this is a part of South Africa and our story that is so often undermined by people who want history to appear to be binary. Wow. You know?
No, that's true. I mean, it's true that there's a problem of the binary nature of historical accounts. But there's also a problem of just plain denial, you know, like plain facts that are just denied, you know, that they didn't happen. And unfortunately, I myself am a product of a particular kind of education that simply erased from history people's stories, people's accounts, and the very idea of struggle.
Well, I mean, we can get into the individual stories in a second, because they're all worth exploring. But in general, it didn't suit the 1948 National Party apartheid regime that there were black advocates before then, that there were black legal professionals, that there were people who were tremendously well read and well researched, and people like Pixley, who we'll get into in a second, who really is someone who I think if we compare, he's on a scale more than comparable to the Nelson Mandelas, and the things that he was doing at his time were probably a lot harder to achieve. And this man was an intellectual tour de force. Yeah. He really was.
Yeah, I mean, part of the sort of white racist mythology was the deliberate erasure of black achievement. And so historical books had to be rewritten, and historical facts had to be represented. And in the course of doing that, the plan was to simply cut out from history those inconvenient parts of it. And it's right to start about 1948, because it's a seminal period. Mm. Because one of the things that have struck me about researching the book has been the very idea that if you actually look at the trajectory of black lawyers from, say, 1903 with Henry Sylvester Williams, right up to the 1940s, because the book ends in 1943, which I'm surprised why it has become so popular, although it specifically ends in 43. But if you end in 43, and then you look between 43 and the 60s, there's actually a gap.
Yeah, you know? Which was on purpose.
Yeah, and exactly the point is that at that point, they deliberately cut off the evolution of black intellectual thinking.
And stultified what people were able to learn there and then.
Precisely. And then, so apartheid, in fact, we can now understand properly as a reversal of black progress.
Well, yes, because people also like to say, well, you know, that black progress was something that was a slow and incremental thing that was, you know, apartheid was just a part of that story. Yeah. But actually, it was this chasm. Everything fell down.
Yes, precisely. And you can see why that is so. I mean, I'm now working on the next volume, which takes the story from 43 and up to 94. And one of the things I've been looking at in the current volume that I'm working on is the impact of the Group Areas Act. Hmm. Because what it did was to drive out, and it was introduced in 55, what it did was to drive out black professionals from the cities.
Yeah.
So, for instance, someone like Pixley, as you mentioned,
Pixley
would not actually have had a place to put an office and to practice in the cities, because those were designated for white people. And they were then pushed out of the cities, literally. And you can see that pushing out of the cities is not just denial of land or denial of housing. It's also an intellectual stultification.
But isn't it interesting, because you also will end up with enemies on the other side now. You'll end up with your obvious enemies and the enemies of most of sane society today, the people who would say that apartheid was a good thing. Obviously, those people are you know, going to dislike this work. But there are also people on the left who will dislike this work, because they'll say, well, there weren't black middle class intellectuals, because everyone was treated as a worker, and workers were this mass of uneducated people who had no rights. And this doesn't suit their narrative either, because you can't have an intellectual black advocate pop up in 1903. It doesn't fit the narrative.
No, of course. I mean, this questions all our accepted stories, actually, about class questions. About
I found it very uncomfortable in some places, because I suddenly had to go and reintroduce myself to stories that I didn't know about our own history.
Yes, I mean, even the stories about evolution of mining and the fact that actually at the heart of Bambaataa, what we've learned about the Bambaataa uprising all along has always been this idea that the hard tax was introduced and there was a rebellion. I mean, the story has always been projected as a rebellion. Mm-hmm. But what we now know from one of the material that I was able to put in the book, what we know is that actually the hard tax was a deliberate strategy to drive labor from Natal to Transvaal. Mm-hmm. And the strategy was instigated by what was called the landlords, the mining bosses. Right. They wanted labor because the Chinese were refusing to work in the mines because the mines were becoming more and more dangerous. And native labor was then supposed to replace Chinese labor. And the one way to do it was to insist on a hard tax paid in cash, when they knew that African people did not have a cash economy because they relied on cattle.
Right.
But by insisting on cash, that drove them from the countryside to the cities. So in a sense, you can see the emergence of the proletarization of workers from Natal to Transvaal. Mm. And that story actually was not the first time. It had happened in 1894 in the Eastern Cape.
You know, history is interesting because it's often written by the people who win, who want it to be written a certain way. But now we have the tools, because there is, you know, a large amount of historical information, which if you're prepared to go and dig, you can find. But we have the tools now to be able to develop a more comprehensive view of history. I'm just surprised, because I know you're a very busy man. You're an advocate. You're constantly doing, you're taking on the President of the Republic. You're doing all kinds of interesting things, which we'll get into now. I'm surprised that you've had the time. This must be a passion project for you. This must be something that drives you, that fulfills some part of you that isn't being fulfilled by all the multitude of other things that you get to do as an advocate in your position.
Yeah, no, that's true. I mean, this also is a deeply personal story, because I myself have been trying to find where do I actually fit in the legal profession. Because when I was a student, there were just no black voices, whether as lawyers or as judges or as just as makers of history. And so having been presented with that kind of skewed narrative of history of law, I have been trying to investigate for myself to find out where do I actually belong. And this continued even when I started practicing as a lawyer, because I began in a human rights organization which was run by white people who meant well and they were good to me and they liked me and I liked them. But I still always wanted to understand, but why is human rights so white? So in a sense, it's been a story of personal discovery. And I mean, of course, I've got my own personal story about a father who wanted to be a lawyer in the 1980s. And I always imagined if he had become a lawyer, what kind of a world he would have inherited. Actually, he began wanting to be a lawyer in the 70s. So I wanted to understand what kind of a legal profession he would have inherited had he actually become a lawyer. So in that sense, there is a personal story, which is why I've been passionate to try and find out. Of course, what I wasn't prepared for is that actually the story goes far back to 1903. In other words, it is as old as this concept called South Africa itself.
Right. Well, in some ways, that's almost comforting, because it makes you realize that we always think that we are living in difficult times and there are insurmountable odds. And, you know, there are questions that are going around politically and economically and socially at the moment that make people uncomfortable. But actually, they've always been there.
Yeah, I mean, that's so true, including what we today term transformation, mm-hmm. access to work by legal professionals.
Yeah.
The idea, I mean, one of the things that, you know, are interesting is to realize the struggles that Henry Sylvester Williams had to go through in the Cape, just accessing basic legal work. And when I've presented my book to black advocates in the Cape, they stand up and they say, but this sounds like you're telling my story. And we've made progress, but we have not made progress at the same time. And of course, me and you today are not going to be locked up for having a political discussion on air.
Sure. No, of course, but they would have been in those days.
And in those days, they would have been. So there has, in fact, been progress in that sense. But I was struck by the idea that people could see themselves in the characters that I've written about in the book.
All right, so this title is provocative, and you knew when you wrote that this would get attention. And maybe some people pick it up without reading the subtitle, and they go, ah, this is about the land. I mean, it largely is, and you dedicate a whole a chapter, basically, with some subdivisions to the land. But, you know, this is such a... Right now, this is so relevant. Right now, the context couldn't be better for something with a title, The Land Is Ours. What's amazing is that you're not talking just about geography. You're not talking about the physical land here. You're talking about the space,
yes,
the ability to own an intellectual history which has been denied not only black legal professionals, yeah, but black intellectuals by and large.
No, precisely.
And we've had in South Africa in recent times almost there seems to be this kind of dislike and distaste among certain kinds of politicians for black intellectuals, for black excellence. They pervert the term and tend to make it something which means you're a political apparatchik rather, yes, than that you're a thinking individual.
Yes, well...
Is that insulting to you?
Well, there is a word for it. It's called clever black.
Yeah, well, didn't a former president who you've been in opposition to many times, he was the one who coined that phrase, right?
Yes, absolutely. This is the interesting bit, Gareth. If you actually look at the origins of the ANC, it is formed by intellectuals.
Absolutely.
Who are actually not ashamed of being intellectuals, or actually proud of their intellectual heritage. But at the same time, they are not...
Who could not be? I mean, isn't this a self-evident thing?
Precisely, yeah.
If someone is... No one calls themselves an intellectual.
No.
But if you are esteemed by your peers to be someone who has some mental fortitude and some ability to discuss and argue and contemplate and understand the world from whatever point of view, and particularly in terms of the point of view espoused by black people who were so disenfranchised, so kept out of the circles of intellectualism at the time, then surely those people should be esteemed.
No, absolutely. And they, nevertheless, were asking themselves the question, I mean, and this is what the concept of the talented tenth. So they were asking themselves that now that we've had the privilege of acquiring, granted, Western education, what are our obligations to society as a whole? And hence they were able to transcend the narrow sort of legal practices into thinking broadly about how to improve society. But the one thing they were so clear about is that they did not need to be white appendages. What they needed to do is to stand on their own, you know, and so they were able to stand on their own intellectually, and then they thought they could also stand on their own politically to liberate themselves. Mm-hmm. So this idea of the struggle for freedom as something divorced from the struggle from intellectual freedom is actually ahistorical.
Tell me about Henry Sylvester Williams.
Yes.
He's the start of the story in so many ways. So who was this man? What did he do? Give everybody a very brief history, and then they can get your book to read the rest.
Yeah. So Henry Sylvester Williams was born in Trinidad, and this is one of the most fascinating stories that when I start the chapter around Sylvester Williams, I start with setting in the Cape in 1903. If you had arrived in Cape Town in 1903 and you saw black people, what Joseph Conrad calls...
The heart of dark.
Yeah, calls... flat-nosed, brown-skinned. If you saw those people there, where would they come from? And the truth is they would not have come from the Cape. They would have come from the entire black world. They would have come from Trinidad, from Jamaica.
The diaspora, really.
Yeah, really, yes.
Because this is, you know, at that stage everything was racial, but it wasn't necessarily... it wasn't legislatively complicated. It was racially complicated.
Yes, because the laws in the Cape at that stage allowed people from everywhere to come and work in Cape Town.
It's amazing. So we were more liberal in 1903 than we were in 1950.
So Cape Town became this melting pot of black talent across the world. So he then emerges in that context, but he has a particular interest in Cape Town because he is the man who has founded 3 years earlier in 1900, who has founded the Pan-African movement, the very first Pan-African conference in London.
This predates all the others.
Oh, it predates everything else. What we know about Pan-Africanism.
Obviously, Biko and everything else.
Yeah. What we know about Pan-Africanism.
Sobukwe.
Yes, exactly. Is that Sobukwe launches the PAC in 1959, but the first Pan-African Association was established in the Cape in 1901, consequent upon the activities of Sylvester Williams. But when he arrived in 1903, he wanted to practice as an advocate, and he became the very first black barrister to practice in the Cape. Didn't stay long. He stayed only for 3 years, because the racial politics of the Cape, although the law was liberal and there was a professing towards liberal ideology, the practice was different.
Was it hard to find source material on him?
Oh, yes. I think on everyone, it was so hard to find source material. I traveled, I think, 3 times over a space of 5 years to London to find the material. So I made the joke the other day that the British didn't only take our land, they also took our history.
So did this guy make the impact that he hoped to make, and was his legacy very quickly forgotten? Because it seems to me that a lot of it was stamped out on purpose, but that maybe there also wasn't enough interest.
Yeah, I mean, he's largely forgotten now, and that's the start of the chapter on him. But at the time, I mean, if you went to the Cape and you read the newspapers in 1903 at his arrival in October, everybody spoke about this Negro fellow, this black man that is arriving to practice in the Cape, because this is happening for the first time. The same thing in 1905 when he leaves. If you look at the black newspapers that were reporting, they were actually sad to see him go. And they regretted the fact that the white liberal establishment couldn't accommodate and couldn't stand the idea of a black man standing shoulder to shoulder with his white counterparts in court.
Well, the picture that you have of him is him in his advocate's robes.
Yes.
With his wig on, which was a thing that people used to do. I mean, in some parts of East Africa, they still wear wigs, don't they?
Yeah, they do. It was funny. I think I went
Kenya,
to Botswana.
Tanzania.
Yeah. I think I went to Botswana about 4 years ago, and I found people wearing these wigs, and it's so odd. Although, I mean, if you look at the other picture of Monsiwa, it's quite striking, isn't it?
Yeah. I think it's beautiful, because in some ways, these are the people who are... They're not only assimilating into it from the point of view of they don't need extra resistance.
Yes.
But they're also standing, as you say, shoulder to shoulder. So there's no, I'm going to rebel against this because actually I can change it from within, which is sometimes more powerful than, you know, brandishing a placard and complaining that the whole thing must be torn down. I somehow feel that you're a kind of an activist advocate from the inside in that respect. Although your profession is very respectable, and you do all of your professional duties as respectfully as any, I think that you are someone who is able to give people what you maybe didn't have when you started in the profession, a lightning rod around which they can perhaps project their own hopes and aspirations as young black advocates. I mean, I don't want to put too much pressure on you, but I think you are doing that.
One hopes, of course, with what you have is to question the paradigm, is never to accept the paradigm. But of course, to first understand the paradigm, you know, and that's actually quite critical. And that's one of the lessons actually from this book, is that they first tried to get inside the story and understand how it works, and then start thinking about how to break down the paradigm so that it's accommodative of interests that are outside.
And not throw the baby out with the bathwater, because there are lots of things that, you know, Western liberalism has granted the whole world, which we now take for granted as being the basics around democracy and freedom and liberty and free speech and all of these things.
Yeah. And also question how those apply in an African context, and how do those concepts advance the cause of freedom. I mean, if you look at basic ideas like freedom, ideas like equality, and ideas like dignity, there's nothing inherently Eurocentric about those ideas.
Right.
They can be applied as instruments of freedom across the world. They were applied in France, in America. In fact, they became the rallying cry for Africans themselves, if you look at what they decided in 1943.
Well, absolutely. And I mean, if you think about, for example, the idea of knowledge and the pursuit of knowledge, which was as much stamped out in Europe during the Dark Ages, as it was reintroduced to Europe by the Ottomans and the and the Muslims of Andalusia during the 1300s. I mean, there's this huge story of how history goes up and down for everybody.
Yes.
And in effect, the good stuff should ride those waves and the bad stuff should sink, right?
Yes. No, absolutely. I mean, when I was in Cape Town last week, someone raised the example of how Alfred Mangena, through the case that he ran, Mangena versus the Times and Mangena versus Lloyd's.
So he was the first attorney to be admitted in the Transvaal.
In the Transvaal.
Right.
Well, he was actually admitted as an advocate in England, but because the laws of the Transvaal did not allow black people to practice as an advocate, he was then forced to apply to practice as an attorney.
Yeah,
and they opposed that, and he represented himself in a case called Mangena versus Law Society and won the case. You know, so if you look at his contribution in England, I mean, he ran the trial. Mangena versus Lloyd, Mangena versus the Times, and won the case. And in so doing, contributed to the law of torts in England. And part and parcel, if you went now to England, to Oxford, or to London School of Economics, and everywhere, and you ask for a textbook on the law of torts, one of the standard cases that every student must learn is Mangena versus Lloyd.
Precedent.
Yeah, as precedent. Yeah, it's Mangena versus Lloyd and Mangena versus the Times. And no one actually bothers to think, how did that case emanate? Because the roots of that case are in South Africa. So in a sense, I mean, your point about knowledge being cross-cultural and cross-continental is a vital point, because here we have 1906, a case that emanates from the Cape, being run on British soil with its historical roots in South Africa, but informing British common law. It's a vital point, you know, and that becomes then part and parcel of the English legal system. And the same thing with a case that comes later in this country called Ntobi versus Berlin Missionary Society, a case run by George Monsiwa, one of the characters that I deal with in the book, which is a case about how to terminate a lease agreement. And the roots of that case are in the 1913 Native Land Act and the fact that black people were not allowed to register property in their names, and they always needed a white intermediary. And in that case, they got the Berlin Missionary Society. And as white people always did, they start off as tenants and then they want to be owners.
Hey, don't paint us all with the same brush. I prefer not to be an owner. Have you ever been a landowner? It's a hard job.
So even that idea that actually what you had here in the Ntsobi case, you have this black lawyer who contributes to the development of South Africa's common law system. And that, again, has largely been erased from history.
And women, I mean, I was fascinated to read about women who had entered the legal profession at a time when you wouldn't have expected any women to be in it. It's still quite biased in favor of men and against women.
No, of course, the bias against women persists even today.
Sure.
But I was interested in researching, I mean, you know, deliberately went out to try and find the stories of women. And there is this interesting case, Woki versus Law Society, where this woman tries to apply for articles to be registered. This is already in 1921. And the Law Society refuses on the grounds that women do not have the predisposition to practice as lawyers. And
they don't have the temperament.
And the temperament, yeah, to practice as lawyers. You know?
Listen, I've met some women lawyers. You could not be more wrong.
Exactly. And then the judges, of course, agree with it. You know, they say, yes, of course, the judges, I mean, the women do not have the temperament to practice as lawyers because they're too emotional. And this is taken over by the legislature, which just changes the law in 1923. And thereafter, women are allowed to start practicing. But it was not only until 1963 that the first black woman actually started practicing.
It's a long window.
Yeah, I mean, of course. So even though the law was changed, the structural problems in society still made it difficult for women to practice as lawyers.
I want to talk about Pixley, Kaisagaseme, because I think a lot of people who study much about us, our history in this country, stop too soon. They don't go back far enough to include him. And this man was extraordinary, not just for his time, but would be extraordinary today.
Yeah.
The capacity he had for advancing so many different interests at a time where those interests were completely ignored. his own, you know, wildly ahead of its time ability to get involved in the most rigorous intellectual debates available at the time was quite something. And for again, all the reasons that we are already aware that it was inconvenient to have such a clever man.
Yeah.
When you're trying to denigrate an entire race of people, he is a very inconvenient character.
No, he was for the old regime. Absolutely brilliant, absolutely gifted. I mean,
I read about him being at Oxford.
Yes, well, he had already been at Columbia at the time. He had already been at an Ivy League university before he was accepted at Oxford University. And when he was at Columbia, he won the highest oratory prize, which was an international prize, and they competed, and he gave the speech about the regeneration of Africa in 1906, and it was that speech that catapulted him to international stardom. I mean, newspapers at the time in Rhodesia, newspapers in Canada, everywhere were singing his praises because he had given the most riveting speech. And if you look at the content of that speech, it was so far-sighted because, of course, at the time, the problem with Africans was a problem of tribalism. So he was of the view that in order to build a nation, we have to destroy tribalism. But he was also able to locate...
I can't help thinking that if he were around today, he wouldn't be terribly charmed by the idea of identity politics.
No, I mean, he was he had transcended, you know, his own tribal identity. Mm. But also, he was not interested in race politics as such because he actually believed that individuals should be judged according to the content of their character.
Way ahead of Martin Luther King.
Well, that was way before Martin Luther King coined the phrase. You know.
In fact, I can't imagine that Martin Luther King didn't come across his name at least once or twice.
Yes, well, in America, Pixley was a big name.
Right.
I mean, in the American civil movement, civil rights movement, Pixley Guyzagasem was a big name because black Americans sort of congregated around his idea of judging people according to the content of their character. And his idea of locating African civilization in the grander scheme of civilizations across the world, and speaking about Egypt as a civilization, and speaking about Morocco as a civilization, speaking about Congo as a civilization in a world that just did not recognize Africa as a civilized place at all.
Well, the other really interesting character here is Msimang, Richard Msimang.
Yes.
And you dedicate a whole chapter to him, but fascinating not just because of his intellectual pursuits and his contribution to our understanding of the place of black men at the time and all the rest of it, but also because of the way he dealt with people and this reputation which preceded him everywhere he went because he was so courteous and he was so dignified and he had such a way of charming people around him, even his enemies.
Yes. No, he was great. I mean, there is an article that a newspaper article that referred to me as one of the most gentlemanly players that I've ever come across, and this was the journalist talking about him as a rugby player. I mean, so he had this effect on people that they generally congealed around him. You know, they generally warmed towards him because of his personality, and even when he was at Taunton, he was elected head of the debating society, first secretary of the debating society, and then elected head of the debating society for 3 years. And then when he was a rugby player, elected vice captain. Interesting story about it is that at Taunton, which is the town where he played for Taunton FC, the Springboks went to play there, I think in 1912 or in 1913. And that was a year after he had returned. And I just couldn't help but be struck by the idea that the Springboks could have gone to play in Taunton during a time when Msimang, perhaps, was vice-captain.
Jeez, can you imagine? Now, that would have really been a mess up in the history books.
I know. So it's most interesting. And, I mean, he has, of course, probably his thinking ideas around the land question are probably the most profound, because it's through him that I had a better understanding of the impact of the 1913 Land Act, that it was not just about the land, but it was also about this intellectual deprivation, about this deprivation of knowledge, and also about the deprivation of assets, cattle, plows, goats, sheep, and labor. And this is him who wrote this seminal
paper. Dismantling of the black economy.
Yes, and and as you pointed out earlier, the dismantling of culture. Mm. You know, so because one of the points he was complaining about is that people are being removed from their graves, and graves are central to African culture because they constitute also a place of worship. So if you're removing people from their graves, you're essentially removing them from themselves. And it was him who points this out in his writings, because he was asked by Saul Plache to go around taking black people's stories. And then he comes up with this incredible body of knowledge. And then he reports that to the ANC, at the time the SANNC. But he also writes an academic paper on the impact of this. And again, that academic paper is largely forgotten, never read, and never actually understood.
Well, again, it's a reason that this book is so important. So you mentioned the SANNC. That was formed by Seme, by Pixley, and then it was seconded by Mangena.
Yes.
So all your characters come into focus at that moment.
Precisely, they come together in.
But Pixley never wanted to be president.
No, he didn't. They had nominated someone he had great respect for, John Langalibalele Dube. Mm-hmm. To be president, and John Dube didn't attend the actual conference where he was elected. There were many stories at the time about why he didn't go. I mean, the one theory that was bandied about was that he didn't want to upset General Louis Botha. The other was that he was running a school. He had opened a school at Ohlange.
Did he have a relationship with Botha?
Yes, he has a long-standing relationship with Louis Botha, emanating from the imprisonment of the Zulu king Cetshwayo.
Mm-hmm.
And there the deal was that as soon as Botha the union was established, one of the first acts of Botha was the release of Cetshwayo, who had been arrested earlier in connection with Bambatha. And that was a very symbolic thing for Dube, because he then regarded Botha as someone of good bona fides.
Mm-hmm.
And so he trusted him in that sense. And so the story that was bandied about was that, well, he didn't want to upset him by being seen to be among the agitators.
To be an out of control native.
Exactly, yeah.
Unruly.
Exactly, so that's why he didn't.
Isn't this interesting that, like, even at that stage, it was possible for people to work towards. I mean, I'm not talking about his not making himself available now for the SANNC, but I'm talking about the fact that he and Botha could establish a relationship where it wasn't by any means equal.
Yes.
But certainly there was mutual respect.
Yes.
And that things could be done in order to secure and advance black people's positions in society, even if it was in this case the Zulu king, but certainly the people could be treated with some level of respect and dignity. Because often when we look back at history, we're told that there is none of that.
Yes. No, I mean, obviously, I mean, one of the points I make.
And we're talking about the pinnacle of society. We're talking about, you know, Louis Botha and Dube. We're not talking about, you know, the ordinary rank and file, where there was obviously much less of that.
No, of course. I mean, the relationships were complex, because they are relationships of power, but they're also relationships of dependence. Because in a sense, in order for the SANNC to function itself, it needed a level of dependence on state power. Mm-hmm. And the same thing with chiefs, in order for them to exercise power, they needed a level of dependence. So you have this contradiction.
Yeah.
One on the one hand of challenge, but on the other hand of mutual dependence. Because in a sense, although the white government wanted to overlord over black people, they realized that they actually needed the leadership of Africans in order to rule over an entire mass of the country, because there were just so many Africans.
So there was, so there would have to be give and take.
So in some instances, there would have to be this symbolic act, you know, just like the release of the Zulu king.
But that all stopped in 48.
Yes, I mean, 48 was a particular perverse period, because the kind of like Nazi ideology that dominated apartheid, I mean, was particularly perverse, because at that point, once the National Party became government, everything was about race.
Do you ever think about what could have happened if that National Party election win hadn't taken place in 1948? Do you ever think about how the trajectory of history, not just for black people, but for all of us in South Africa, might have been different if Smuts had won again, or even if things had advanced, that the pace of change had happened faster?
Yeah. I mean, I always wonder about that because...
That was our dark age.
Yeah, I always wonder because one of the points about these lawyers and the leadership of the ANC at the time was their reliance or their faith in the ability of the British to sort of bring about a more equal, and at the time the language was native franchise, you know, to bring about
sure.
native franchise.
Because, I mean, we look at what happened maybe in India yeah. and what happened in other African countries yeah. where they were once lorded over.
Yes.
By these colonial masters, but ultimately established in very different ways to the way yeah. we established our freedom,
yeah.
their own ability to have agency.
Yeah, absolutely. But I always wonder about the class question. I mean, if you assume that 1948 didn't happen, there was still going to be a consolidation of a particular aristocracy, mm. perhaps around financial interest, perhaps around education,
yeah.
perhaps around some other feature. Because what the National Party was able to do was to treat black people as the same, regardless of what their positions were in society. They pushed them out of the city.
It's like a dual socialism.
Yes, basically.
There was a socialism for whites and there was a socialism yes. for blacks. And socialism for yes. whites meant improving the condition for Afrikaans, poor
yes.
whites.
Yes.
And trying to kind of equalize the economy
yes.
and
yes.
create ownership of companies for white Afrikaners
yes.
from what was essentially an English ownership of the economy
yes.
at that stage. And then there was socialism for blacks where actually all
yes.
black people were treated equally,
yes.
but in a totally different way to the whites.
Yeah, they equalized downwards for the blacks and equalized upwards for the whites.
There we go.
Yes.
You've, with your silver tongue, you've done it better than I. This is why you, this is why you command huge fees as an advocate.
Command no fees at all, for the most part, yeah. No. I do get paid sometimes. Yeah. So I mean, your point is a good point. I mean, so we have to always question, you know, what would have happened, you know, had it not been for 1948. But I mean, the point is that the origins of racial segregation did not emanate from the National Party. I mean, the idea of petty apartheid, of pushing people off,
sure.
Black people off the cities, is an English idea.
Started with the first governor of the Cape.
Yeah, yes, it is an English idea, really. And they were married to this form of eugenics from the late 1800s, really.
Which was an ugly branch of Darwinism.
Yeah,
I mean,
and
by
was,
no means
yes.
is it Darwinism, his contribution to human
yeah.
emancipation, showing that we're all related, showing that we're all the same,
yeah.
showing that we have kinship with animals
yeah.
is not something egregious and ugly,
yes.
but it was perverted by that eugenic...
Yeah, yeah.
They called it science, of course it wasn't.
Yeah.
It was like phrenology and all of those other discredited sciences.
Yes.
But it was accepted...
Yes.
Hook, line, and sinker by the nationalists and
yes.
by the Nazis.
Yes, no, absolutely. Oh. Well, by the English first. I mean, Thomas Carlyle.
Right.
Yeah,
that's right.
Thomas Carlyle was an influential thinker who, in fact, branched into eugenics. And when people like Sir George Grey, who was actually a friend of Thomas Carlyle, when people like Sir George Grey were at the Cape, they were believers in some form of eugenics, you know. And then even later, after 1884, after the Berlin Conference, it was in fact practiced widely. And of course, the Germans in Southwest Africa, the National Party here, I mean, they took it
yeah.
to another perverse level and enforced it in law and enforced it in practice.
When you have the context of these stories of these people who have changed in small ways and in big ways the fabric of South African law
yeah.
and of international law in the case yeah. of Mangena.
Yeah.
And you look at what we've got now, there's still so much legislation. It seems like it's really not a priority for our current dispensation to rid ourselves of some of the completely outdated and unnecessary regulatory and legislative stuff
yeah.
that the apartheid regime created. There's still a lot of it around.
Yes. No, absolutely. I mean, there was a project.
You would think they would immediately have set
yeah.
to work.
Yeah.
Let's abandon these yeah. bad principles.
Yeah. No, you would have expected that, you know, as part and parcel of the enforcement of the constitutional project, that the first item would be what is called sort of the decolonization of the law, you
yeah.
know. But unfortunately, we are still grappling with the foundations of law as largely having been colonial foundations of law. Our laws of property, our laws of contract, our laws of delict, all of them still need to be rethought in order to be framed through what we call the constitution. But the constitution itself, sometimes you feel that the way it's interpreted still takes its cue from the common law, whereas it should be the other way around.
Well, that's interesting, because part of the byline of your book is South Africa's first black lawyers and the birth of constitutionalism. And I read enough to get an idea that you aren't entirely a constitutionalist, but that you have some sympathy for it.
Yes. I mean, it depends on what constitutionalism is.
How do you define it?
So, I mean, if you look at constitutionalism as a set of values anchored around equality, freedom,
yes,
and dignity,
right,
then, of course, I do support that version of constitutionalism. But if you look at constitutionalism as a narrow set that essentially tries to protect privilege, then, of course, I reject that form of constitutionalism. So, yes, I support a constitutional project, but I don't support a constitution. I support constitutionalism, you know, the idea that we've got to move towards a pan-African future for society. So I don't think my pan-African outlook to the world is contrary to constitutionalism. I think the two need to be blended.
How much of the work of these people that you've written about informed the next generation, who were the ones who were more famously the pan-Africanists that we know from history, the Sobukwes?
Yeah.
How much
yeah.
did the work of, you know, Pixley,
yeah,
and Simang, for example,
yeah,
inform them? Yeah. Even I was reading this. There's a very interesting document, the African Claims document,
yes,
which you
yes.
put in here.
Yeah, absolutely.
And I could see Z.K. Matthews' name is in there
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
How much did these guys have to do yeah. with what came next?
Yeah. So the person who stood in between those generations, of course, you've mentioned Z.K. Matthews, and he was not a practicing lawyer. He wanted to be a lawyer.
Mm.
And your point earlier about these connections and contradictions, he wanted to be a lawyer, and he spoke to Dennis Raitt. So Dennis Raitt, who ultimately a firm was named after him.
Mm-hmm.
And Dennis Raitt gave him the options that he could be an academic.
Not
as well.
Anymore. It's now Norton Rose. He's been wiped out of history too.
Yeah. And so he gave him the options that he could also be a legal academic. He also became a giant of note, an intellectual giant of note, because
yes.
he went to Yale University where he did his MA, and he went to the London School of Economics where he specialized in anthropology.
Mm.
And then he came back. When he came back, he was a professor of both history, he was professor of history, law, and anthropology at Forte University. Could have become principal, but the National Party would not allow him to become principal of the university, because at that stage they were working towards the extension of University Act, which essentially was to Bantuize education.
Plus, like some other people we know, they didn't like black excellence.
I know. And so the character I wanted to introduce into the story is not Z.K. Matthews, but it is Anton Lembede.
Mm-hmm.
Because he stands
in
between.
He's the first president of the Youth League.
Precisely. He
yeah.
stands in between these generations, because he was Pixley Ka-Isaac Asseme's article clerk.
Huh.
And then he also became the president of the ANC Youth League at a time when Mandela, Sisulu, Tambo, all of those people, they had this big meeting, and they spoke to Abe Nxumah and asked him for permission to form the Youth League. And Nxumah refused, but he said you could do an organizing committee. In that organizing committee, they then used it as a space to launch the Youth League. The person that they all agreed should be president was Anton Lembede. He was a brilliant man, probably the most brilliant of his generation, qualified in chemistry, qualified in philosophy, and qualified in law, and had all of these qualifications. He unfortunately died too early, but he was a more radical thinker who developed this idea of the program of action, which was explicitly pan-African. At that point, they were moving towards isolation, because they were saying the older generation that saw pan-African as part and parcel of a larger human movement had not achieved the objectives they had set for themselves. So they need a more Africanist version to pan-Africanism. And hence he started with ideas of non-racialism. He started with ideas of Africa for Africans, Africans for humanity, humanity for God. And that man was then Anton Lembede. His ideas ultimately served as the basis for the formation of the ANC Youth League.
Hmm.
the dispute that came in 55 between the Mandelas and the Sobukwes, the Tambos and the Sobukwes, was around who between these two is the proper inheritor of Anton Lembede's ideas.
And we know who won.
It's unclear. I mean, you know...
We know who won from the point of view of who took the mantle on and who ultimately derived the greatest benefit from that mantle.
Yes.
I always find the saddest thing for me about Robben Island isn't the prison and it's awful and the quarry or anything else. It's that little house of Robert Sobukwes.
Yeah.
I mean, that man's isolation was just absolutely inexplicable.
Yeah. No, and also the fact that it was not an isolation because of a judicial decision.
No.
The judge said he should go to jail for 3 years. But he ended up staying there for, 6 years. And the reason he stayed beyond the period was because of a political decision. So he was truly a political prisoner.
Mm.
And they were obviously afraid. I mean, one of the things I've been interested in investigating is what was Parliament actually deciding?
Yeah.
And what were they discussing?
I mean, he was such a dangerous person.
Exactly.
Such special treatment.
Yeah, and this is one of the most fascinating things about them, is that they were more afraid of his ideas. Because he actually didn't commit any crime.
Nothing.
You know, he didn't bomb anything. They just, you know, he did go to...
Who do you think was the heir to the Lembede ideas? Which faction do you believe was more close to the truth?
Yeah,
you've read, obviously, plenty of what Lembede must have wrote down and what he was involved in.
Yes. Yeah, I mean, I think that perhaps Robert Sobukwe was probably closer to Anton Lembede's ideas. And there was a point when Nelson Mandela was also married to those ideas.
Mm.
But I think that his sort of Pan-African intellectual ideas were influenced largely by the SACP. But yes, I think that Sobukwe is probably closer to Lembede.
It's an incredible book, and there's so many names that we haven't got to Poswayo and all of these people.
Yes.
Who I think, you know, would be fascinating for people to read this. If you're interested in legal history, then it's a no-brainer. If you're interested in history, it's a no-brainer. And if you're interested in intellectualism in the early 1900s, up to, you say you're busy with the next installment.
From 43
onward. From 43 onward. But if you want to know a little bit more about what people seem to, and I hear lots of pseudo-intellectuals these days claiming that they understand history, but you've gone to an enormous amount of trouble to actually discover what the truth was. And this, to me, is very valuable stuff. So thank you, Tim Becker. You're adding such detail to our comprehension of our own past. It's terrific.
Thank you, Gareth. Thank you for inviting me. It was a real pleasure.
Yeah, and I'm sorry it's taken so long for me to actually see you since you handled my case against MultiChoice. I think I still owe you a drink or two.
No, we should, actually.
I would love to talk about this some more. This book is absolutely incredible. Please take a look at it. South Africa's First Black Lawyers and the Birth of Constitutionalism. The title of the book is called The Land is Ours. Tembeka and Kwai Tobi. Pleasure to see you.
Cheers. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Wow. What a conversation. What a book. All right, there's lots to think about today. I'm not going to give you more homework. That's about it. That's all we got time for. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Have an excellent day and blah, 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 blah.
This is CliffCentral.com.